He slapped his thighs. He laughed silently for a while because he was out of breath. He laughed until he had tears streaming from his eyes.
I bet it was just like that, Mr. Druid,
Coyote finally managed to gasp.
Then priest would come up to the soldiers and say, In the name of the Father and the Son, here's a cracker. Now go kill some fucking Indians.
And abruptly the laughter died in our throats, and our smiles fell quietly like death shrouds on the fallen. It was simply too close to the truth to be funny. We spent some small while staring down at the flower bed in front of my porch. I cannot speak for what Coyote was thinking, but personally I was haunted by the ghosts of those who had trespassed against me. I was the only survivor of the Holy Roman Church's war against Druidry. Coyote eventually wiped at his cheeks, finished off his Stella, and said,
Thanks for the beer and the laugh, Mr. Druid.
He stood up and put the empty on my porch rail, then held out his hand to shake, a huge grin on his face again.
You'd be a good guy if you wasn't so damn white.
I shook his hand firmly, grinned back, and said, And you'd be a good guy if you wasn't a damn dog. That set Coyote off to laughing again, but this time it seemed not entirely human. He let go of my hand, and then I saw what was happening. He fell to all fours, and in another heartbeat, he was bounding off my porch in his animal form, yipping his amusement into the cool November night. He didn't even leave any clothes behind. They just sort of melted away somehow. Oberon noticed, too.
Bitchin', he said. You should learn how to do that.
Right. I looked down at Oberon and clapped my hands together as Coyote disappeared from view. Now we can go see the Polish witches.
I think Coyote's messed with your head, Oberon observed. You just said that like it's some sort of treat.
Chapter 5. Detecting some ambivalence, I asked Oberon if he'd rather stay home than visit the witches.
Actually, a one doesn't sound all that great right now, he admitted. I just had all those sausages. I think a nap would be nice. Maybe you can pop in a Clint Eastwood movie for me.
Sure. Besides, you don't like witches, right?
Well, no. But neither do you. Except now you're ready to trot over to Melina's gingerbread house because she said so, and right after someone tried to off you, I might add. Have you thought that maybe you're making her day here? Do you feel lucky?
I guess I know which kind of Eastwood movie you'd like to watch. I got Oberon set up in the living room with a dirty hairy flick, and then took off on my bike, sword strapped to my back in plain sight, heading for Melina's condo near Town Lake. Ever since I'd started to carry Fraggraw around regularly, just in the last few weeks, I had noticed an interesting phenomenon. Hardly anyone thought it was real. Most people took a look at the guy on a bike with a sword and assumed I was still living with my mom and harboring an unhealthy obsession for anime. Or they supposed the sword was a prop for a role-playing game or some other fantasy, because the idea of carrying a sword for personal defense in an age of firearms caused them too much cognitive dissonance. While I paused at the stoplight on Millen University, one citizen even inquired if I was on my way to the comics shop. Melina lived in the Bridgeview condos, a 12-story tower of glass and steel built just after the turn of the century in Tempe's rush to develop the Town Lake district. She and the rest of her coven owned the entire ninth floor, though now there were 6 vacancies. Granuel, my apprentice, lived on the 8th floor, directly underneath the condo of Radomiwa, the coven's erstwhile leader. I thought it would be wise to check on her before knocking on Melina's door, so I rang her bell.
Who is it? Her voice called through the door. Oh, it's just you.
She answered the door in something scanty,
and I experienced a moment of panic as prurient thoughts pushed aside the innocent inquiry I'd been planning to make about her safety. Granuelle was not plain. She was a tall, lithe redhead with green eyes, a mouth that looked delicious, and an extremely sharp mind. The latter was most important, for otherwise she would not be my apprentice. It was difficult to dwell on her mind, however, when so much of her athletic build was on display, more than I had seen to date, in fact. She usually dressed very modestly, and I appreciated it, because it kept my thoughts of her, mostly, innocent. But now that she was dressed in a low-cut, pale-green nightie, all slinky and clinging to her shape...
Baseball. Must think of baseball. Not the curve of her... Curveball! Randy Johnson has a wicked slider, too.
Oh, how I would love to slide. Atticus, what's wrong?
Huh? Oh, hi.
I'd been reduced to monosyllables by a nightie. Why are you looking up? Is there something above my door? She took a step closer to me and leaned over to see where I was looking at, and... Oh, my.
There's some titillating wallpaper up there. Yes, fantastic interior decorating here. I just noticed.
You've seen it before. What's going on?
Just the facts, Atticus. Someone attacked me tonight, and I wanted to make sure you were okay, I said, trying to remember who held the record for stealing second base.
Oh, well, yes, I'm fine. Who attacked you?
Still trying to find out. It was a magical attack, not a physical one. Actually, there was a physical one, too, but that was a demon, and an elemental killed it for me, so that's all right. The ghouls are on their way, but I'm not sure my neighbor's ever going to be the same, though you don't have to worry about Oberon. He's fine.
Sweet honey of Dagda, now I was babbling. What?
Granuelle said. Look, there's no time to discuss it. Just lock yourself inside and close all your windows. I'm going to put a ward on your door to keep you safe tonight while I go deal with this.
You think someone's going to attack me?
No, no, it's a precaution only. Now get inside and close the door. Shoo! But open up the shop for me tomorrow. I won't be in till after lunch.
All right,
she said uncertainly. She turned and I looked at the ceiling so that my peripheral vision would not drag my focus downward.
I guess I'll see you tomorrow then.
Sleep well, I said as the door closed, shutting that body away from my eyes, and I sighed in relief. Damn, I need a cigarette after that. And I don't even smoke. Druid's Log, November 1st. Buy attractive apprentice some shapeless, ugly clothes as soon as possible. Maybe convince her to shave her head as well. Tell her all the cool druid initiates are doing it. I didn't need to put a ward on Granuelle's door, since I had placed one there a week ago without telling her, right after she returned from North Carolina, and confirmed she still wanted to be an initiate. After taking a couple of deep breaths to regain my composure and focus on my purpose, I used the stairwell to head up to the witch's floor. I had no illusions that I would catch them unawares. They probably knew the moment I'd entered the building, much less ascended the stairs to their floor. I took a moment to mutter a binding on all my hair and skin to make sure none of it escaped to fall into the hands of a witch. I had to be careful with my magic usage here. 9 floors up from the earth, I had a limited supply of energy upon which to draw, just what was stored in my bear charm. I can't really sling magic around the way witches can in any case. In a situation like this, my sword would serve me better. Fragara, the answerer in Irish, wasn't simply a sharpened piece of steel. The Tuatha De Danann had given it a couple of bonus utilities when they forged it ages ago, and I intended to employ one of them now. I drew it from its scabbard, thereby breaking a state law or two about deadly weapons, and opened the door to the 9th floor. The hallway was clear and uncomfortably silent, the lights dimmer somehow and the air close and quiet like the dark, stuffy space underneath a blanket. On the other floors, where trust fund college kids and young professionals lived, you could hear muted music and laughing and the Daily Show's mockery through the doors. The witches were having none of that. "It's Atticus," I called, as I rapped my knuckles on Melina's door. The percussive sound seemed to offend the hallway's sense of decorum, and the quiet chastised me as it dropped into my ears like cotton balls. I stood presenting my left side to the fisheye peephole so that my sword arm was hidden from view. While I waited for her to answer, I thought of how stupid I was being right then. Oberon's words rang in my ears, along with the shrill voice of paranoia in my head. Meeting the witches on their own turf without a non-aggression treaty and without support of any kind was really asking for it. I still didn't know quite what they were capable of. If Melina was to be believed, they had held this territory against all comers for nearly 30 years. The threshold could be booby-trapped or enchanted. I could be walking into a cage fight with a demon. Hell, she could open the door with a Glock 9 in her hand and put a bullet in my ear, or throw a cat at me, or call me a damn hippie. She did none of those things. I heard the locks tumbling open, regular, everyday locks, and then she stood before me with red-rimmed, puffy eyes and said,
"The Suavas did."
It took me a moment to process that she'd said someone's name. I know 42 languages, many of them extinct now, but Polish isn't one of them, and in general I'm not that great with the Slavic tongues. Vasława, I recalled, was one of the names on the list of Melina's coven members. "I'm sorry," I said. "How did she die?"
"The police will probably call it spontaneous combustion," she ground up bitterly. "But there was nothing spontaneous about it."
Melina wore a diaphanous purple tunic over a white camisole. She had on a black skirt that fell to her knees and hugged her hips. Her legs were sheathed in black tights, and she wore pointy, high-heeled ankle boots of jet suede. Her lips were painted a soft pink, and now they were pressed together in regret. I marveled again at her hair, gentle waves of blonde silk that one simply never sees except on silver screens, framing her face and spilling down past her collarbone. Normally, her skin was white and smooth as marble, inviting caress, but now it was flushed and blotchy because she was upset. She opened the door farther and gestured.
"Come on in."
I didn't move. "Forgive me, but I need 2 questions answered first." I moved my sword into view, but did not raise it or threaten her with it. "Will you answer?" Melina's eyes flicked down.
"If I answer incorrectly, then I get the sword?"
"No, the sword makes sure you answer correctly. It's kind of special that way." Melina narrowed her eyes.
"What sort of questions?"
"Nothing about your coven secrets, nothing personal. They regard my immediate safety only."
"Do I get a quid pro quo?"
I sighed. Everything with this witch was a negotiation. "I freely tell you I have no intention of attacking you without being attacked first."
"I already knew that. I want to know about your magic."
"No, that is not a quid pro quo," I shook my head. "The value is not the same." Melina raised her eyebrows.
"You are suggesting that innocent questions about your magical abilities are more important than questions of your immediate safety?"
"Of course, for the answer to the latter will do me no good past this evening, and the former will inform you forever."
"I am too upset to enjoy fencing with you about this. Ask your questions about personal safety."
I raised Fragros slowly, deliberately, and pointed it at Melina's throat.
"Fragroitu,"
I said in Irish, and Fragra turned cold in my hand, its blade gleaming blue and enveloping Melina's head in a soft cloud of cyan light. The witch blinked.
"The sword can cast a spell?" she said. "Most unusual. Was this the reason Angus Og wanted the sword so much?"
I was sure it was one of the reasons, but the true answer had more to do with Fey politics and a personal vendetta against me. I had not come to discuss my sword's magical capabilities. "I'll ask the questions," I replied. "Did you have anything to do with the attempt on my life tonight, or do you have any knowledge of who might have been involved?"
I personally had nothing to do with it, nor did any from my coven, but I do have knowledge of who might have been involved.
The temptation to ask who was nearly overwhelming, but I bit it back. It could wait, and I only had one question left. I carefully composed it, then asked, "Do you or any other person, creature, or spirit within your home intend to cast any spell on me while in the building, or are there enchantments that I may unknowingly trigger during my visit?"
"Neither I nor any other person, creature, or spirit in my home intends to cast a spell on you. I do not wish to tell you about our enchantments, for I feel that intrudes uncomfortably into the area of coven secrets, which you promised not to explore."
Melina frowned for a moment and then continued, her eyes widening as she realized she could not stop herself.
"But of course you tripped an enchantment the moment you walked into the building, as all non-residents do. A simple low-level alert. And another that identified you as carrying a magical item. And then another in the hallway that... Zorya Vershevnaya, Zomkni Miusta!
I really needed to pick up some Polish if I was going to continue dealing with Melina, though I did catch that she invoked one of the Zoryas, the star goddesses from whom her coven derived its power. "Whatever you're trying, it won't work," I said. "You must answer the question fully before you are released. You were speaking of an enchantment in the hallway?" Melina decided to try a physical response. She attempted to slam the door in my face, or at least made an abortive movement as if she wanted to do so. That was when she discovered Fragorah wouldn't let her move more than a couple of inches. Since the sword's enchantment had been originally intended to interrogate highly hostile enemies, it was a defensive measure more than anything else. Can't have people stabbing you when you're pumping them for information. I smiled gently and said nothing. The only way she could be free now was to answer the question, and the spell would compel her to speak soon enough if she insisted on being silent. She insisted. 15 seconds later, a decent holdout, she was telling me everything about the hallway and glowering at me for it as her volubility waxed.
"The hallway has an enchantment that removes a few hairs from your head if you do not leave on this floor. Crossing the threshold of my door will do the same thing. There is a knife in my kitchen that will slice into your fingers if you try to use it, thereby producing blood we may seize upon. And if you use our bathroom, your waste will be stored for later use."
"Ew, gross," I said. First impression of a valley girl ever, I swear.
"That is all. Release me from this spell now,"
Melina said. "I have promised to ask you only 2 questions regarding my safety, and that is what I have done. The fact that you did not want to answer the 2nd question demonstrates I had good cause to be worried. And, of course, you did not want to answer because you know that possession of my hair, blood, or any fragment of my cells for magical purposes is expressly forbidden in the non-aggression treaty we have yet to sign." Melina seethed quietly, and I continued. "I am going to release you shortly. Before I do, I want you to know I hold you and your coven blameless in the recent attempt on my life. I'm not going to ask you any more questions now, for that would violate my promise, but I would appreciate it very much if, once you are released, you would share what you know about who tried to kill me. If the party responsible for attacking me is the same party that killed Vaswava, then I offer my aid in avenging her." The witch's expression softened minutely, and after a brief hesitation, she gave me a curt nod.
"That is reasonable. I will return any hair taken from you immediately, and dispel the enchantment on my threshold so you may enter safely. But you will never use the sword's power on me again, nor on any member of my coven."
I didn't nod or give any other sign that I agreed to that, but instead released her and said, "Let us proceed then." I was curious to see whether the silent hallway had succeeded in taking my hair when I had put a binding on it, specifically to prevent that from happening. "Who attacked me?" I asked.
"Just a moment," she said.
She spoke a few words of Polish, and the doorframe flared with white light for a brief second.
"It's safe for you to come in now."
"Thank you," I said, and stepped into her condo. It was decorated in purples, ranging from intense violet to soft lavenders, and anchored by black leather furnishings and steel appliances. The wall above the obligatory big-screen TV boasted a large painting of a triple goddess figure, presumably the Zoryas. Pale wax candles dotted the room with fingers of light, emitting a scent of orange peel and cardamom.
"I think custom demands that I offer you refreshment," Melina said as she moved to the kitchen. "But you won't take any, will you?"
"No, but I thank you for the thought. It is a meaningful gesture in itself."
"Will you be seated?"
She gestured toward the inviting leather couch in the center of the living area. The black coffee table had several magazines scattered about on it. Newsweek and Organic Living and Rolling Stone, I noted with some surprise. Then I wondered at myself. What did I expect? Ritual Animal Slaughters Quarterly? I almost accepted her offer because the couch did look comfy, but then a tense whisper of caution suggested that she could say something in Polish and make it eat me. "I prefer to stand, thank you, and with my sword drawn, though I will keep it pointed at the ground. I do not wish to take much of your time, only what is necessary to establish who attacked me and to retrieve anything of mine your enchantments may have removed." Melina was not used to being so flagrantly mistrusted, and I think she was close to taking offense. But let's face it, most people outside her coven didn't know she was a witch. They thought her nothing more than an alluring, successful, cosmopolitan woman with glamorous hair and a penchant for wearing sexy boots.
"Fine," she said shortly, pulling a cork out of an already open bottle of Rosemount Estate Shiraz that waited on her granite countertop.
She started to pull a glass out of her cupboard, but then thought better of it and tossed the cork carelessly over her shoulder, deciding to drink straight out of the bottle since I wouldn't be partaking.
"Let's get to it, shall we?"
She took a gulp or two for courage before continuing.
"Vasuava is nothing more than a collection of cinders now on the lake shore, thanks to a certain hex I haven't seen since my younger days in Europe. It's not something my coven can do, I assure you, nor would we want to. This hex cannot be cast without the aid of dark powers, and it takes 3 witches in tandem to cast it. That," she said, aiming her bottle at me meaningfully, "should give you an idea of what we're confronted with."
"If I was targeted at the same time as the rest of your coven, it means we're dealing with 2 dozen witches plus 8 demons."
"Correct. Well, the demons may not still be around, but I'm sure they left something of themselves behind."
Her eyes grew round significantly, and I began to wonder how much wine she had already consumed. "Oh, no. Let me guess. 8 of those witches are eating for 2 now."
"Very good, Mr. O'Sullivan. That's generally how these things work. In 9 months, 8 demon babies will be born, and more soon after if the witches care to try again. There's only one coven large enough and soulless enough to try this, and we have run into them before. They call themselves the Doctor de Dritten Houses."
"The Daughters of the Third House?"
"Yes, they are the bitches I was referring to on the phone."
Her face twisted, and she looked as if she was going to scream a curse or 5, but she mastered her temper in time and instead observed calmly,
"I see you speak German."
"Yeah, several versions of it. Why did you survive when Vasuava did not?" Melina shrugged.
"She was outside when it happened. The rest of us were at home. Here on our floor we are very well protected, as I am sure you are protected somehow. Had we all been outside at the time of the attack, we'd all be dead."
"If that's so, then you would think that they would have timed the attack better to ensure more of you were vulnerable."
"You are assuming they are aware of our defenses. They have no conception of the wards the Zoryas provide us. Their magic is as different from ours as it is from yours. To their way of thinking, they have cast a hex no one can survive. They will be surprised to learn otherwise."
"Why was I targeted? Why were you targeted, for that matter?" They targeted us partially to settle an old score, she replied, tapping her chest with the bottle and then remembering it held a rather tasty vintage. She took another drink before continuing and moved into the living area.
But mostly we, and I include you in that we, are all that's left protecting the East Valley Territory, whether you realize it or not.
I didn't sign up for that.
It's not the sort of thing one signs up for.
She put her fist up to her mouth briefly to mask a delicate belch.
They perceive you to be a guardian of this area, therefore you are. Perception is reality, Mr. O'Sullivan.
Why not go after the werewolves? Or Leaf?
They represent entirely different spheres of influence. The werewolves care only about other lycanthropes. Since magic doesn't touch them, they couldn't care less who rules the territory. The vampires care only about other undead. We, on the other hand, must worry about all magic casters.
Must we?
Look at places with high crime. The West Valley, as opposed to the East Valley, for example. The West Side cities, including Phoenix, have higher rates of crime, poverty, and auto accidents than the East. Why do you suppose that is?
Socioeconomic status and poor civil engineering?
No, it's because the West Valley is not under our aegis like the East is.
You are suggesting that your coven is solely responsible for the East Valley's relative peace and prosperity?
Not solely responsible, just largely responsible. The Zoryas are protective goddesses, not the vengeful sort that wants blood in sacrifice.
That's fascinating, I said, but hardly germane to the point, which is where can I find this German coven and how do I kill them?
Kill them the way you killed my sisters,
Melina said coldly. She didn't know I hadn't really killed any of them. Five had been werewolf snacks, and the sixth had fallen prey to another witch, one who was on my side.
As for where they are, I imagine they are in town somewhere. I cannot give you a precise location because I do not know myself. We will attempt to divine their location after midnight.
Excellent. I will try to divine their location also. Would you say this coven is more powerful than yours?
Certainly they are at the moment, outnumbered as we are. They left us alone while we were at full strength. But now they know we are depleted. The East Valley is a lovely place to live, and they think they can win.
Can they?
In a sense, they already have. We cannot leave this floor of the building until the threat of that hex is removed, because we cannot protect ourselves individually from it. At the same time, we are unlikely to defeat them solely by magic with only six of us. So it is up to you, Mr. Sullivan, to go out and thwart them if you can.
I think you're confusing me with a superhero. Heroes go around thwarting dastardly villains. They give the evildoers to the police, and the bad guys always say they would have gotten away with it if it weren't for those meddling kids. A groove appeared between Melina's eyes as she tried to attach my words to something that made sense to her, and I could see she failed. Not a big fan of Saturday morning cartoons, I guess. Druids, on the other hand, take revenge on people who try to cook them.
Well, that I can understand.
Good. Tell me why the East Valley is so desirable.
Why do people fight over it, you mean?
Melina gave up pacing the living room and plopped herself on the comfy leather couch, tilting her bottle of Shiraz yet again. Yes, explain it to me as if I were a child, because in truth I have never understood the territorial urge. Why do groups of magical beings fight over pieces of real estate when we could easily spread ourselves thin over the surface of the earth?
I thought it would be obvious, Mr. O'Sullivan. In a densely populated industrial society, the citizens are predisposed to think of magic as ridiculous. Therefore, it is easier to blend in, easier to prey on them, if we were so inclined, and far easier to profit from them. As a single individual, you can go where you wish with relative ease, but a larger group needs a larger herd to hide in, and a larger economic engine to afford us the life we'd prefer to live.
Urban centers are therefore both our protection and livelihood, and it is natural that we compete for the choicest places to live.
You can't share?
To some extent, we can, yes. We share this territory with the Tempipec, for example. We share it with you. But when too many magic users populate a given area, the risk of exposure increases, as does the risk of overtaxing the economics.
I beg your pardon. How exactly do you overtax the economics? I run a bookstore and apothecary shop. All members of the Tempipec have legitimate jobs. Don't you do the same?
Melina laughed. Why, no, Mr. O'Sullivan, I don't. People give me everything I want. The same goes for my sisters.
You mean people just give you money?
Yes, that's right.
She twirled a lock of her hair around a finger and smiled brightly at me. Of their own free will?
Well, that's how they remember it.
She shrugged a shoulder and raised a hand palm up.
So it must be true, mustn't it?
She smirked wryly. And you have no moral problem with that?
None whatsoever. Actually.
She leaned forward and lowered her voice, as if sharing a confidence in a public place.
We are on the payrolls of 24 different companies as consultants, but we do absolutely nothing for our paychecks, just like normal consultants.
She leaned back and continued at normal volume.
We do, however, provide a service to the people of the East Valley.
Dare I ask what that may be?
Why, we keep it free of truly nasty witches, of course, as well as some of the less savory citizens of America. There are parts of Mesa that could easily become like the dangerous parts of big cities if it weren't for us. And that's what will happen if the Doctor Distritten Houses takes over this territory, not to mention the damage that the Bakkans can do once they get here.
What? Bakkans are on their way here? Now?
Even as we speak. You know, the ones from Las Vegas. I mentioned them to you before, didn't I?
Yes, I believe so. I struggled to appear nonchalant, but I was dangerously close to needing a new pair of underwear. Back when I was an initiate, this was decades before Jesus, Bakkans were the scariest creatures in the world, according to the Archdruid. Anything that could scare the Archdruid damn well gave me nightmares. I nearly shat kine whenever Bakkus was mentioned even obliquely for my first few centuries. Kids today don't know much about the Bakkans, except perhaps for the story about Orpheus told in Ovid's Metamorphoses. I had an ASU student looking for it in my shop last week, and he defined the Bakkans for me as those drunk chicks who killed that one dude because he wouldn't have sex with them. His professors must be so proud. I asked him if he knew what Maenads were, and instead of correctly answering that it was just another name for Bakkans, he bizarrely thought I was referring to my own testicles, as in, "Here now, mate, don't swing that bat around Maenads." The conversation deteriorated quickly after that. Now that I'm much older and hopefully wiser, I know that the Archdruid's fear was partially his own chauvinistic terror of women who did whatever they wanted. But I also know that it was partially well-founded. Bakkans carry around Thyrsi, which are staves wrapped in ivy leaves that give them the power to throw an instant party. Slap the ground with them, and wine bubbles forth. They dance and drink themselves into a frenzy, and then they acquire tremendous strength, sufficient to rip apart a bull, or a man, with their bare hands. As a corollary, their frenzy tends to have a ripple effect on people around them, turning fairly civilized parties into orgies of debauchery. It isn't the sort of magic that specifically targets anyone, and I suspected much of it had to do with simply stimulating human pheromones, so I feared my amulet wouldn't protect me from it. In addition to this, Bakkans are not burned by fire, and they cannot be harmed by iron weapons. The former didn't really apply to me because druids don't go around chucking fireballs at their enemies, but the latter presented me with a huge problem, since I basically used my sword whenever I wanted to do unto others before they did unto me.
Bacchants were therefore well protected against the talents of druids, while I feared myself defenseless against their magic.
"We have driven them back twice in years past,"
Melina said,
"but now they not only outnumber us, they can also fulminate a fine frenzy without fear of us showing up, because we're stuck here until the German Hexen are destroyed.
I wouldn't be surprised to discover that the two groups are working together to take over the territory."
"This," I said with a sardonic smile and waggling my left index finger at her, "is starting to sound suspicious to me." Melina's eyes widened in mock surprise.
"Only now it's starting?"
"Yes," I said, ignoring her sarcasm. "It sounds to me like you want me to run around and take care of your problems while you just hang out at home and watch The Notebook or something." I changed my voice to her pitch and tried to affect a Polish accent.
"Go slay the German Hexen for me, druid, and while you're at it, take care of those bothersome Bacchants and win one for Orpheus."
Melina glared at me.
"Was that supposed to be an imitation of my accent? It sounded like a Russian trying to imitate Bela Lugosi and failing miserably. My accent is far more sophisticated and dignified."
"My imitation of your accent is not the issue."
"Well, I'm making it one. And besides, you offered to help avenge Vasuava."
"And so I will. But what does your coven plan to do to fight the Hexen?" I asked. Melina deflated, considered her bottle, then thought better of drinking any more and sighed heavily, throwing her head back on the couch. The movement flung her hair about her head like a yellow whirl of silk, coming to rest on the black leather cushion like a halo. She had the power to enchant her hair so that it made men give her whatever she asked for, but I was beginning to think she hardly needed to use magic on it. The white column of her neck beckoned, and my eyes followed the arrowhead formed by the hollow of her throat and her collarbones, downward to linger on her...
"Baseball! Focus, Atticus! Any kind of liaison with Melina would not end happily."
"We have to find them first," she said, "which is the point of tonight's divination. Once we know where they are, we can fight back from here. Nothing so dramatic as 8 simultaneous hexes, but we will pick off one here and one there until you are ready to confront them directly. I will keep you informed, and when the Bacchants get here, most likely tomorrow night, I'll let you know where they are as well."
"Then I suppose there is nothing left to discuss except whatever you have of mine that you really shouldn't."
"Oh, yes."
Melina pushed herself up from the couch and put her wine bottle on the coffee table, weaving a bit on her boot heels. She gathered her hair and tied it back in a knot, talking affably to me as she led me to a bedroom currently doing service as a witch supply closet.
"I do hope we'll get around to signing the non-aggression treaty soon, Mr. O'Sullivan, for despite your uncomfortable questioning when you arrived and your barbaric insistence on walking around with your sword hanging out, I feel we can live and work together peaceably going forward and even prosper, once these current troubles are behind us."
That wasn't English she was speaking. It was the language of diplomacy.
"I have no objections to peace and prosperity," I allowed.
Melina's witch closet, in contrast to the decor of her living area, was painted a pale moss green and lined with cedar shelves sporting rows of glass bottles. I tried to find one with something unspeakable in it, a human brain or deer lips or otter balls, but saw nothing but herbs, oils, filters, and a curious collection of claws from big cats. She had claws from tigers, snow leopards, lions, and black jaguars, as well as cheetahs, cougars, and bobcats. She also had beaks from several birds of prey, but otherwise her supplies were entirely plant-based. In the center of the room was a wooden work table bought from IKEA's kitchen department. It supported the obligatory mortar and pestle, a knife for chopping, a peeler for tubers, and an electric hot plate she had plugged in via extension cord. I was vaguely disappointed to see she had a regular saucepan resting on the hot plate rather than a black iron cauldron.
and even more disappointed that there wasn't a hapless amphibian in there. A smaller copy of the large painting in the living room hung opposite the work table. The three Zorias watched from the walls, waiting to bestow their blessings on Melina's work.
"Who supplies your herbs?"
I asked. "I could probably be of assistance if you're having trouble finding something of sufficient quality and freshness."
"We get most everything at an herbalist in Chandler,"
Melina said,
"though I'm sure we're going to need much more bloodwort shortly if we're to deal properly with the hexen. Have you any available?"
Bloodwort was one of many common names for yarrow. Witches used it in some divination spells, but it could also be used in spells of both protection and attack. For my part, I employed it extensively in my apothecary business, including in several proprietary tea blends. Virus immunity for the onset of colds and flu, digestive facility for various gastrointestinal ills, and a truly trippy mixture I called enhanced visibility. I made the latter for artists who wanted to see the world differently because in sufficient concentrations, yarrow could cause a temporary color shift in the eyes. "Sure, I have pounds of the stuff because I use it all the time. I grow it in my backyard, all organic and very potent. How much do you need?"
3 pounds should safely see us through," Melina nodded. "Could you have someone bring it to us?"
"Certainly. I'll send a courier in the morning. You can pay him. I'll send along a list of my other herbs in stock, too, and another list of what I can grow for you, provided that you give me sufficient notice."
"Good. Let there be commerce between us."
Melina moved over to a shelf near the painting of the Zorias and looked at an uncorked, unlabeled bottle, also uninhabited by anything that I could see. Sitting next to it on the left and stretching down the length of the shelf as well as 2 shelves above it were jars containing locks of hair with people's names labeled on the front. All of those people were completely in Melina's power, whether they knew it yet or not. I felt a twinge of pity for them.
"It should be here,"
Melina said tensely.
"The last person to visit this floor was the officer who informed us of Vasuava's death."
She pointed to the labeled jar next to the empty one. Inside was a lock of sandy hair, and emblazoned on the label in purple ink was the name of Kyle Geffert.
"Your hair should have been deposited in this empty bottle here," she said,
then looked up to the air vent through which her air conditioning was softly blowing. Presumably, any hair collected from visitors in the hallway got routed through the ductwork to land in the empty bottles, but nary a red hair from my head was to be found in any of them.
"What in the name of Zorya Untrenyaya is going on?"
Melina scolded the bottle, as if it would answer her, and I fought to keep a smile off my face.
"Ha ha, my personal binding was stronger than her enchantment. Neener, neener, Melina.
You can't catch me." Chapter 6. Washing a filthy Irish wolfhound is entirely unlike washing a chihuahua. It takes 3 or 4 buckets of water just to get the wolfhound thoroughly wet, for example, while 1 bucket will most likely drown the chihuahua. I have discovered over the years that if I wish to remain fairly dry through the process, I must distract Oberon from the tickling of bubbles and soap with a really good story, or else he will shake himself mightily and spray water and foam on every wall of my bathroom. Bath time is therefore story time in my house, and Oberon enjoys getting cleaned up as a result. What I enjoy is Oberon's obsession with the story until the next one gets told. He'd been vicariously living out the life of Genghis Khan for the past 3 weeks, constantly badgering me to muster the hordes on the Mongolian steppe and start a land war in Asia. Now, I plan to take him in a completely different direction. "When we were messing with Mr. Samarjian's head earlier," I said as I began to soak him, "you asked me who the Merry Pranksters were. Well, the Merry Pranksters were a group of people who joined Ken Casey on the Magic Bus in 1964 for his trip to New York from California."
"Ken Casey had a magic bus? What could it do?"
Its primary talent was scaring the hell out of social conservatives. It was an old-school bus painted in day-glow colors, really bright fluorescence, and given the name of Further.
So Casey was some kind of warlock?
No, just a gifted writer. But I suppose his magic bus started the Cultural Revolution of the 60s, so that's pretty powerful magic. The pranksters would give away acid for free to whoever wanted it in an effort to shake people out of their dreary lives of conformity. Acid was legal then.
Wait, you never told me what acid was.
It's the street name for LSD.
I thought the street name for that was Mormon.
No, that's LDS. LSD is a drug, and they called it acid because the full name was lysergic acid diethylamide.
That sounds like it comes with lots of side effects.
Fewer than most prescriptions nowadays, I said, applying a sudsy sponge to Oberon's back. But back to the pranksters. They dressed in day-glow colors, too, tie-dyes and funky hats, and all had really cool nicknames like Mountain Girl, Gretchen Fetchin, and Wavy Gravy.
Wavy Gravy? Seriously?
Every word is true, or I am the son of a goat. I had him now.
Well, that's the coolest name I have ever heard in my life. What did Wavy Gravy do?
So, I told Oberon all about Wavy Gravy and the electric Kool-Aid acid tests, the origin of the Grateful Dead, the entire hippie scene, and the moral imperative to stick it to the man. I made sure he understood that Mr. Samarjian was the man, and we had been sticking it to him really good so far. He came out of the bath all clean and ready to put on a tie-dye shirt with a peace sign on it. As Oberon paraded around our living room spreading peace and gravy, "Gravy is love," he explained, my subconscious chose that moment to allow a bubble of memory to boil up to the surface. Did Mr. Samarjian really say he had a rocket-propelled grenade in his garage? I didn't think those were available at gun shows, so I put it on my list of things to investigate, then hit the pillow, grateful to have survived another day. Chapter 7. I made sure to make a proper breakfast in the morning, since I would be off fighting demons. A fluffy omelet stuffed with feta cheese, diced tomatoes, and spinach, sprinkled with Tabasco, complemented by toast spread with orange marmalade and a hot mug of shade-grown Fairtrade organic coffee. Having slept on it, I decided that the only thing to do about the Bakkens was to make somebody else get rid of them. It would cost me, perhaps dearly, but I'd live through it, and so would Granuaile. I'd considered using wooden weapons, or perhaps bronze or glass ones, but regardless of weaponry, I'd still have 12 or so insanely strong women to defeat, and no defense against catching their madness. It was time to work the phones. First, I called Gunnar Magnusson, alpha of the Tempe Pack and head of Magnusson and Hawk, the law firm that represented me. Werewolves wouldn't be affected by the Bakken's magic. He received me coldly and rebuffed me in short order.
"My pack will not be getting involved in your territorial pissing match," he said. "If you have legal matters to attend to, then by all means call upon Hal or Leaf. But do not think of my pack as your personal squad of supernatural mercenaries to call on every time you get into trouble."
Clearly, he'd been stewing over the aftermath of our battle with Angus Ogg and Melina's Coven. Two pack members had died that night in an effort to rescue Hal and Oberon. There was no use arguing with him in such a mood, so I simply said, "I beg your pardon. May Harmony find you." It seemed I had plenty of fences to mend with my lawyers. It would be futile to call Leaf. For one thing, he was hiding from the sun at this time of day, and for another, he'd want me to go after Thor in exchange for his help with the Bakkens. Though I didn't want to do it, I placed a call to North Carolina, dialing a number Granuaile had given me when she returned from there last week. It was the number of Laksha Kuliskaran, an Indian witch who now went by the name of Salai Chumkani. The name change was necessary because Laksha's spirit now inhabited the body of Salai, a Pashtun immigrant from Pakistan who had been in a coma for a year after an auto accident.
Since Salai had already become an American citizen years ago and had convenient documents and bank accounts already in place, and, more importantly, no desire to awaken from her coma, Laksha slipped out of Granuel's head and into Salai's, thereby acquiring such accoutrements as a house and a husband. The husband was foremost in Laksha's mind when I asked how she was adjusting to her new life.
"He is disturbed that I emerged from a coma with a strange accent and a new sense of independence, but so thrilled that I seem to have lost all sexual inhibitions that he's willing to overlook my disrespect."
"Men are so predictable, are they not?" I grinned into the phone.
"For the most part. You have managed to surprise me so far," she replied.
"I'd like to invite you back to Arizona for a short while."
"See? That is most surprising."
Killing Radomiwa and half her coven has left something of a power vacuum in the area, and some undesirable things are rushing in to fill it. I could use your help, Salai.
"Please, when we are in private, continue to call me Laksha. What kind of undesirables are you dealing with?"
"Bakkans."
"Real Bakkans?"
Her voice sharpened.
"Genuine Maenads from the old world?"
"They're coming here by way of Las Vegas, but yes, they are that kind."
"Ah, then that sword of yours will be of no use against them."
"Right," I agreed.
"Could you catch a plane out here?"
"I will pay for it."
"You will pay for much more than the plane," Laksha said. "You want me to bring karma to these Bakkans, am I correct?"
"Yes," I admitted. My old archdruid would have said the only good Bakkant is a dead Bakkant.
"But by doing so, I will increase my bad karma, and I have a dire karmic debt, as it is. You will owe me a great service in return."
"I can pay you a significant sum of money."
"I do not speak of money. I will require a service of you, as you are requiring a service of me."
"What kind of service?"
"The sort that you can perform and I cannot. I will call you from the airport when I arrive and explain then. It will probably be late in the afternoon or the evening by the time I get there."
"That's fine. I will look forward to seeing you, Laksha." I tried to think of what service a scary, body-snatching witch might require of me, but after a few seconds I dismissed it as idle speculation when I had other things to do. I called my apprentice to give her instructions for the morning.
"Atticus, are you all right?" she asked when I called her. "You kind of worried me last night."
"Sorry about that," I said, blushing in embarrassment and glad she could not see. "I was demented after fending off a demon attack. I'm going out to kill another one, a big one with Coyote, but I should be back after lunch. Couple things I need you to do. Got a pen?" Granuel snagged something to write with and took down Melina's name and address for the Yarrow delivery. "Don't go yourself, make sure it's a courier." I didn't want my apprentice unwittingly delivering her hair into one of Melina's glass jars. "Then, have Perry show you where we keep the applications. I need to hire some more help. Thumb through those, make some calls, and line up a few interviews for later this afternoon. If they're still unemployed, they should be available."
"You seriously need more help? It's been dead in here."
"I'm going to be gone more often. That dead patch of land out by Tony Cabin needs my attention. It won't come back for centuries without my help." Angus Oak had killed many square miles of the earth by opening his portal to hell, and while he would be paying for it by spending eternity burning there, the land was still barren and cried out for aid.
"Oh, yeah, absolutely. Won't you need a car for that, though?"
"Nope. You get to drive me, so you'll be gone more often, too."
"Okay, now it makes sense."
"That's what senseis do. Well, I'm gone, and it's dead in there. Work on your Latin, using that software I bought you." After ringing off with Granuel, it was time to rummage around in my garage. It held all sorts of things instead of a car. Shuriken, Psy, a couple of shields, fishing tackle, and plenty of gardening tools. It was also where I stored my bow, a modern compound number with ridiculous pull on it. I couldn't draw it without magically boosting my strength.
I figured it should give the demon something to howl about. I also found a quiver full of carbon steel arrows and set them next to my bow near the front door. With an hour to kill before Coyote was due to arrive, I jogged up Roosevelt Street with Oberon to visit the Widow McDonough and pay some attention to her lawn. It was only 9 in the morning, but she was already out on her porch, sipping a glass of Tullamore Dew on the rocks and reading a hard-boiled mystery novel. Her weathered face split into a wide smile when she saw Oberon and me trotting up her driveway.
"Ah, me dear lad, Atticus," she cried,
setting down her novel but not her glass.
"You're a fine bloom of spring on a cloudy fall day, and that's no lie."
I chuckled at her poetic greeting. "Good morning, Mrs. McDonough. You could lift a lonely man's heart from 50 leagues away."
"Tish, I'll have to be baking you some brownies for that spot of blarney there. 'Tis yourself that's good for the heart. Come here and give us a hug."
She rose from her rocking chair, glass in hand, and opened her arms to me. She was wearing a white cotton dress printed with a blue floral pattern, and a navy shawl was draped about her shoulders. It was finally getting chilly in Tempe, and it looked as if a cold rain would soon fall to renew the desert. She patted my back as we embraced briefly, and she said,
"I can't imagine such a handsome lad as yourself being lonely for any reason, but it's God's truth that I'm that happy to see you whenever you stop by. Oh, hello, Oberon. That's a colorful bit of clothing you're wearing."
She scratched behind his ears, and Oberon's tail thumped against her porch rails.
"Ah, you're a good hound, aren't ye?"
"Tell her I'm a peace dog, but I think her cats are closely allied with the man. I'm going to stick it to them."
"Can I get you something cold to drink, Atticus? A finger of the Irish, perhaps?"
"Oh, no, thank you. I must be off soon enough to fight some hellspawn, and I can't be impaired in the slightest." The widow had abruptly learned that I was a druid shortly after she learned that werewolves weren't just the stuff of legend. When most people are confronted with a paradigm shift like that, their clutch burns out and they need a new mental transmission. The widow, however, had hardly lost any speed, taking it all in stride and even mothering me a bit when I showed her my missing ear. She'd given me a tube of smelly ointment from Walgreens, unaware that I could make much better for myself from scratch.
"Ah, fighting more demons, are ye? Well, won't Father Howard be pleased to hear that?"
she chuckled. She moved back to her rocking chair and invited me to take a seat next to her. "Father Howard," I frowned, "you've told your priest I'm a druid?"
"Tish, I'm still not that daft, me boy. And even if I were, it's not like he'd be believing me. To him, I'm no more than that saucy Katie McDonough what comes to Mass Mellow every Sunday. He won't be paying me no never mind, regardless of what I say."
"Going to church drunk, I mean mellow, that's pretty groovy. If the magic bus came through here now, I bet she'd hop on."
"You think Father Howard discounts you or takes you for granted?"
"Oh, go on with ye now. Of course he doesn't."
"Okay, sorry, but I had to ask." The widow's face fell, and she stared out at her lawn.
"Well, now, maybe he does a bit."
She turned quickly and shook a finger at me.
"But only a bit, mind."
"How so?"
"Ah, well, you know, I'm the oldest parishioner what goes there. He's quite the youngster himself, and he's there to minister to the college lot. Here I am, a widow whose soul isn't in any danger from temptation, so why worry about me then? I am a settled issue for him. Now I know it's probably just me vanity talking, but I suppose it'd be nice not to feel taken for granted."
"Of course, you deserve to feel appreciated."
"Especially since I might be helping to keep the universe ticking, right? Wasn't that the gist of what you're trying to tell me before you ran over there?"
She waved toward the Superstition Mountains.
"And got your ear chewed off."
"Sorry," I shook my head, trying to clear it of her coarse phrasing. "I don't quite follow you. Remind me of what I said."
"Ye said all the gods are alive. All the monsters, too."
"Oh, right. They're all alive, except for the ones that are dead."
I think you should submit that statement to win the Nobel Obvious Prize,
Oberon said.
And the impression I got was they're alive because we believe in them, right?
With lots of fine print, right.
So, in a sense, it's we with faith who create gods, not the gods who create us. And if that's the case, then it's we who created the universe.
I think that might be taking a big step into the windowless room of solipsism. But I see your point, Mrs. McDonough. A person like you with such powerful faith should not be ignored. Why, faithful people around the world have made miracles happen.
Really? How do they do that?
You've heard of people having visions of the Virgin Mary?
Sure, all the time.
Those are created by faith. You could probably make one happen.
All by myself?
I nodded. Absolutely, Mrs. McDonough. When you think of Mary, what does she look like to you? Could you visualize her clearly for me? Describe her to me.
Why, sure I can. 'Twouldn't be a very good Catholic if I couldn't, now would I?
If Mary were to appear on this earth now, what do you think she'd look like? The widow seemed pleased to be asked.
She'd have the patience of eternity in her eyes, she would, and the beatitudes in her smile. I suppose she'd be dressed sensibly for the modern world, to blend in, you know, something cotton in navy blue.
Why navy blue?
I don't know. It's just what I associate with her. She's not the flamboyant turquoise type, is she now?
All right, go on. What sort of shoes?
The sensible kind. But classy, you know? Not cheap tennis shoes made by a poor wee girl in an Asian sweatshop.
Would she wear one of those habits, the elaborate headgear you always see in churches?
I should think not. It's hardly the fashion anymore. A simple white headband keeping her hair out of her eyes would be the thing.
And if she came here, to Tempe, what do you think she would want to do?
A saintly woman like that? She'd probably be down on Apache Boulevard, ministering to the homeless and the whores and the methamphetamine addicts. What do they call them, that slang term?
Tweakers.
Right. She'd be helping the tweakers, she would, down on Apache Boulevard.
Ever notice how Apache Boulevard is a lot like Mos Eisley? You will never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy.
When Oberon says things like that, it takes all my will not to dive into a Star Wars nerd fest. I resolutely ignored him, because I had to get the widow in the proper frame of mind. That's lovely, Mrs. McDonough. Sure, she would work a powerful lot of good on Apache Boulevard. Why, if she were down there, she could help me slay this demon from hell by blessing my weapons.
That's right, she could. Wouldn't that be divine?
Oberon and I examined her expression and found a tiny smile on the widow's face, pleasant yet inscrutable.
Does she realize she made a pun?
Oberon asked. I don't know. I can't tell.
Dude, she's pranking us right now. She's totally on the bus.
Mrs. McDonough, I want you to concentrate, or rather meditate on this. No, I want you to pray that this happens today, right now, putting all your faith into the power of Mary's miraculous healing and the good work she would do ministering to the addicts on Apache Boulevard. Picture her in your mind as clearly as you can.
And ye think if I do that, then Mary will come down from heaven and walk the boulevard, freeing people from addiction and telling them to go and sin no more?
It's entirely possible. Depends on how she's feeling today.
Well, of course she's feeling dandy,
the widow scolded me.
She's the mother of God, for the love of Pete.
Yes, but Mary has free will, does she not? You would not imagine her as a slave to your prayers. She can decide for herself whether she would like to be made manifest in the image you offer, whether she should intercede or not. Aren't all prayers based on this assumption?
Well, I suppose they are. But it's so strange to think of it like that. It's all backwards.
It's only a slight modification of causality. Faith is the bedrock of it all. It doesn't work without your faith. No religion does.
As a pagan who subscribes to a completely different pantheon, I could never induce Mary to come here.
But, Atticus, how can my one wee prayer...
Faith, Mrs. McDonough, faith. If you want a scientific explanation, I cannot give you one. Science cannot close the fist of reason around the